It's time for conversations again. It's Tuesday. You're listening to KVMR 89.5 FM in Nevada City, 105.1 FM in Truckee, translator K286AN. And this is Michael Stone. It's Conversations. And today we have a conversation with Elizabeth Satoris. She is an evolutionary biologist, futurist, author, consultant on living systems design. And Dr. Satoris shows the relevance of biological systems to organizational design in businesses, government, global trade, and human systems. Her books include A Walk Through Time, From Stardust to Us, Biology Revision, co-authored with Willis Harmon, and Earth Dance, Living Systems in Evolution. Elizabeth, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you, Michael.
It's great to have you here all the way from
Mallorca,
that's right. I don't even know where I am some days, you know.
Oh, don't you love it? The planet has gotten smaller, hasn't it?
Well, that's exciting and scary, and I think we want to get into some of that. There's a story I'd like to start with that I love, and I've heard it quoted by you many times, but I think a lot of people haven't heard it. And it's the metaphor of the metamorphosis of the caterpillar to the butterfly as an illustration of this shift in consciousness and reality that's occurring on our planet. Could you start out by sharing that as a starting point with us?
Sure, I'd be glad to, Michael. I got it first from Nori Huddle in a wonderful little children's book called Butterfly. And it's a story of, I've edited it since then, so mine isn't identical to the original, but basically a caterpillar, you know, chomps through its ecosystem and keeps eating more and more until it's eating up to 300 times its own weight in a day. So it's an interesting metaphor for a rather rapacious economic system we've put in place.
Indeed.
And then eventually it just gets so bloated it hangs itself up and goes to sleep, and its skin hardens into a chrysalis. And then something happens inside, and some imaginal cells, as they're actually named by biologists, start to pop up in the caterpillar's body and become activated. And now these imaginal cells have been stored in discs all through the life of the caterpillar, and that's more recent information than she had. And now suddenly these cells, which have a different genome from the caterpillar, start to emerge and get active and connect up with each other. And eventually they get strong enough that the rest of the caterpillar that they've been kind of feeding on turns into a nutritive soup, and they can continue to form the butterfly with this new genome. And, of course, a butterfly lives much more lightly on the earth. And lately some people have said, hey, are we already emerged from the chrysalis and in free fall? and had we better spread our wings fast now? Well, you know, the old system is in free fall now, it seems. In the story of metamorphosis itself, the caterpillar doesn't really emerge fully formed until that old system has pretty much melted down completely. So we don't know precisely where we are in the story now, but it does make an interesting metaphor, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a very good metaphor. I think the fact of being asleep in many areas, one of those areas, of course, is the change in the very foundation of science itself, from the old mechanistic paradigm into a new type of evolutionary story, is really at the heart of that. And it's interesting that, you know, the information has been out for some time, but in practice it's a system that's dying hard. Can you contrast the old Newtonian paradigm of science, and really the basis of science, with this new emerging story?
Yes, it is interesting, because there is a kind of metamorphosis going on within science itself. And, you know, one of the important parts of the metaphor is that the two systems, the old and the new, coexist for a while. So it's not your usual kind of turning point model where everything disintegrates and then suddenly a phoenix rises from the ashes. It's a matter of transition where the old and new systems coexist, and you can see that very clearly in Western science. Now, I have to go a little bit into philosophy of science so that people understand, because most scientists don't understand this because philosophy of science is no longer taught to them. But you cannot build a science. You can't even make a theory, a scientific theory, until you have some notion of what kind of a universe you live in, what kind of a world this is, and how human beings can study it. Otherwise, you're at a loss to even create a theory, right?
Right, a system of beliefs.
Yes, and they're formally called unproven assumptions. They actually are cultural beliefs of a given historical time and place. So the Western science story that says, for instance, to start with, this is a non-living universe and it can be studied objectively, meaning we can study it without affecting it. We can stand apart from it and study it so that we have good, clean experiments and we're not changing the world by studying it. So those are two unproven assumptions. Non-living universe, and we can study it objectively. Now, if you contrast what kinds of assumptions many of us who have PhDs in Western science have shifted to, we are instead believing that the universe begins in cosmic consciousness rather than in non-living matter. So on the one hand, you have a story where you start with non-living matter and everything evolves by accident in it, and eventually it's all running down by entropy because it started with a big bang and that's just dissipating into space and going toward heat death, and that's the concept of entropy, that there won't be any more usable energy in it. Now, this opposite viewpoint, oh, by the way, in that old story, human consciousness is a late emerging product all the way up when you get nervous systems, you know?
Kind of at the pinnacle.
At the what we think is the pinnacle, because we think
exactly.
We're on top. We forget that it took current earthworms just as long to evolve to their current state as it took us to become humans, you know? Everything is the same vintage, sort of, except something started earlier. Well, of course, we can trace our history all the way back to the ancient bacteria, so we all do go back to the same original planetary bacteria.
But anyway, a very fundamental thing that you're talking about. That, I mean, it's so different that consciousness evolves from matter, basically, versus matter actually comes from consciousness.
Exactly. And so you say, I call it the 180-degree turn, because it's diametrically opposed, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, let me tell you a little story that I run into often, or not too often, but often enough so that I've learned this little script that happens after a talk I give. My assumptions start with the conscious living universe. And so after I give a talk, sometimes a scientist will come up to me and say, "Loved your poetic metaphors, but of course this isn't really science, is it? Wink, wink." And they're looking for a confession now. So I say, "Well, that's an interesting observation. Why do you say that?" And they say, "Well, because you can't prove it, can you?" And I say innocently, "Prove what?" And they say, "You can't prove this is a living universe." So I say, "Very interesting." I said, "I wonder if I could ask you a question and ask you, how did you prove this was a non-living universe?" And they look at you a little strangely, and then they say, "You don't have to." And I say, "Why is that?" And then they say, "Because it's obvious." You see, cultural beliefs are obvious things that you think are facts. So I say, "Well, interesting. I travel the world and I've studied history, and many human cultures don't see that as obvious at all." And then they really smirk and say, "That's because they're pre-scientific." And so I started really looking into this. How could I get them to recognize these fundamental assumptions? Because the fundamental unproven assumptions of Western science have become the creation story in all secular cultures. right?
Mm-hmm.
It is science now that has the mandate in a secular culture to tell you what, how the world got to be what it is, how the universe evolved, and who are human beings, what is their nature, how can we study the universe. All of these things are these belief systems of Western science. And because it tells us we live in a non-living universe, that universe is meaningless, it's purposeless, it has no intention in it, it has no spirituality in it.
And it's falling apart.
And it's falling apart by entropy. So, and even life is going to eventually lose out to this tide of entropy, sweeping it away. So what do? We build a consumer culture and console ourselves by shopping. And people have to get that this story may be the most depressing creation story any culture has ever told,
yeah.
And that it isn't holding up to the evidence science itself has produced, especially through physics, quantum physics, relativity, all these new things that came out of that mechanical worldview and don't show a mechanical universe at all. And I should add that quite a few scientists now are demonstrating very beautifully and mathematically unification theories in which that entropy is balanced by centropy. And, of course, entropy is about radiation. When you look through telescopes, you see expanding radiation. You don't see contracting gravitation. And so when you put the two together properly, you discover that the universe isn't falling apart because it contracts as much as it expands. And you could think of it as a donut that you were turning inside out, you know, so that mm-hmm. the hole on one side is expanding while on the other side it's contracting, and therefore it can just keep turning and stays a donut, doesn't yeah. fall apart, doesn't it go off into space.
You know, one of the things that fascinates me is that, you know, this is basically a belief system, mm-hmm. a cultural belief system. And any belief system has actions that correlate perfectly with that belief system, right?
Sure.
Anytime we're looking at a system. I'd love for you to contrast, you know, these two, what you get, you know, like you made mention of the consumer society in a dead universe mm-hmm. where we're...
No, wait, let me catch you up there, because okay. a dead universe implies it was alive. It's a non...
Good point. Non-living, yes.
Non-living.
Sorry.
Universe.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay. It's a very common error, so I'm glad you made it, because people confuse that term.
Yeah. No, I totally get what you're saying. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting that you didn't say, by the way, in the caterpillar story is how in the nutritive soup, the imaginal discs are attacked by...
Well, that's because I can't find any evidence for
that. Oh, you can't?
Story.
Okay.
No.
I'm going on an earlier version, I guess.
Yes, you
but
are.
But it is
absolutely.
So much like what's happening now mm-hmm. is that the old system is really revolting, and there are a set of actions that come out of these different worldviews, one of being a mechanistic world that mm-hmm. Is, you know, these building blocks eventually mm-hmm. get to consciousness, mm-hmm. and or consciousness was always here, and everything is evolving from consciousness in a larger system. Out of that, you have specific ways of being in the world, and that's the fundamental shift
yes.
that I'm really interested in talking yes. about, our relationship to the world.
Yes, exactly. Of course, the very basic thing is that consciousness pervades everything, that in that view, which is actually the fundamental assumptions of Vedic science. And I think we need to legitimize sciences built on different cultural belief systems. And I run around the world saying to, in Islam, for instance, reclaim your right to do Islamic science. Just acknowledge what your basic beliefs are and then do good theories and do things Western science isn't doing. So it's very important for us to have a science that holds to the fundamental assumption of a living universe, because it will then probably make biology the most important science, and will really come to understand life not as mechanism but as self-organizing living systems, and would then be able to talk to the Western scientists about where they transgress in life, believing, for instance, the genome to be just a mechanism that you can turn screws in and replace them with other screws and stuff, and then really get into trouble doing that, and can be very harmful to life forms to do high-tech agriculture full of toxins and genetic engineering and things like that. So I'm plugging not for the turning Western science into Vedic science, but for legitimizing a whole consortium of sciences in the world that have equal footing and mutually respect each other the way the religions have come to respect each other.
And the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, so that exactly indigenous science should be able to play like everybody else, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not sure I didn't get off track there.
Well, a little bit, but we can get back to that because that's okay. A great way to end the show anyway, to contrast those. But one of the things that I think lay people don't really think much about is the distinction between consciousness and brain. Mm-hmm. It seems to, in many people's thinking, be collapsed. But that's a huge collapse and leads to one of the most fundamentally dangerous, I believe, beliefs that we don't live, we don't think about, we think from, and that's the illusion of separateness.
Yes.
So can you speak to that whole issue of distinguishing the brain, and consciousness and this whole thing of how we hold on to this sense of separateness, which may be part of why Western science is grasping so tight to the Newtonian perspective.
Yes. Well, one way to look at this problem is that in Western science, there's all this linear causality in which you start with this non-living universe and things are moving around by accident and they bump into each other and then something works and other accidents happen and you get this slow chain of build-up with a Darwinian evolution story after you do the matter part. And again, by accident, the genome gets rearranged and stuff and one species leads to another. But when you have the opposite fundamental assumptions about everything beginning in consciousness, first of all, you never have to derive life from non-life because you don't have a concept of non-life, and you don't have to figure out how to get consciousness out of non-consciousness because you started with consciousness and everything evolving within it can have its own version of that same consciousness. And it's all, there is no way to pull it apart into the individuals as separate entities. So the first great benefit you get from that kind of a worldview is the recognition that we are all one. And even biologically, we're all made of the same proteins and the same genes. They're all interchangeable, which is why scientists can mess around with moving them around, yes. But nature herself has done huge amounts of mixing and matching of genes, as in the case of the caterpillar, where long ago some creepy crawly thing ate some flippy flappy thing and then hung on to its genome through all succeeding generations doing life in two stages. And so another way I look at it is if you think of yourself as a keyboard, a piano keyboard, and you hold the low keys to be the matter of your body, and then the middle range keys as you go higher up the piano are electromagnetic energy, which is also you. You are an electromagnetic energy pattern. So when Einstein came along, you know, electromagnetic energy had been considered a sort of woo-woo new age thing in the Victorian age, you know. And then Einstein showed that we can, or other people showed that we can measure it, and Einstein showed that we can transpose the music now up and down the keyboard, that energy is transferable into matter and matter into energy. Now the scientists who started in the low keys are getting up even to the upper end of electromagnetic energy, which they call zero-point energy, and which is now held to be the source of all the particles that then get denser and form the matter lower down on the keyboard. Now, spiritual people, people who are more interested in consciousness than in science, have started, it's like standing on the upper end of the keyboard looking down while the scientist is standing on the lower end looking up. And they don't realize that they're all on the same keyboard, that we are not bodies with minds, with souls, or souls with bodies. We are matter, we are matter, spirit, consciousness beings, right? We're all of that. We're matter, energy, consciousness. We're matter, energy, soul, spirit. It's one keyboard, and with a human body, you can play on that entire keyboard, which is an amazing thing. You can go from the basest vibrations of cruelty and things of that kind all the way up to the most angelic high vibrations. Very special. And again, we are a oneness. Our cells form a oneness. People are a oneness. The planet is a oneness, see, where there is no separation in that kind of a worldview.
Yeah. You know, it's more than a bumper sticker, this whole thing. And I want to talk with you about self-organizing systems and how, you know, holons and holarchies and how they build on each other and how they're separate, to try to give more understanding of that, how that oneness works and how it manifests.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to that?
Yes, the term holarchy comes from Arthur Koestler, the philosopher, and I thought when I read about holarchy the first time that it simply was talking about the embeddedness of nature, and this is how I use it. All the systems or entities in nature are embedded within each other, so that you, for instance, are a holarchy starting way down with the particles in the atoms and the atoms in the molecules and the molecules in the cells. And then the cells within the organs and the organs within the organ systems and your whole body. So it's like onion skins or like nested Russian dolls. And then you can start another holarchy or continue it with you within a family, within a community, within an ecosystem, within a nation, within a world, within a planet, you know. Or then you can go on. The planet is within the solar system, within the galaxy, and the galaxy is part of a galactic cluster and all the way up to the universe. So you can always look at what any given system is embedded within and what's embedded within it. Right?
Right.
You can look both ways. So it's really a very simple concept, but it becomes very useful when you see some other patterns in nature and put some patterns together. And now the other thing you asked about was autopoiesis, self-organization.
Right. Mm-hmm.
This word was coined by Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela, who were two Chilean biologists in the 1970s.
Wonderful work.
Writing about it.
Right.
Yes, and autopoiesis is a word that literally means in Greek self-creation. Auto is autopoiesi, self-creation. Creating is poiesi, as the Greek word poiesis comes as the same root as poetry. It's like a self-writing poem in Greek. It's quite lovely. Now, I decided I needed a word for mechanism, because autopoiesis was about living systems, in other words, organisms. And I was trying to really understand the difference between organism and mechanism, because Western science saw all nature as mechanical. And that was ever since the Cartesian Descartes universe, where God was the grand engineer inventing the machinery of nature. And science kept this metaphor of machinery, and especially in my field of biology, where there is no quantum theory, so to speak, microbiologists still see every molecule as a little mechanism, and that's why they call it genetic engineering, you know, always these mechanical terms. Well, I was looking at, you know, how do I tell the difference between an organism and a mechanism? And one thing I did was coin this word allopoiesis, meaning not self-created but other-created, as a way of describing machinery, because machinery always has an inventor, an outside agent creating it, whereas a living organism grows from within, from a seed or an egg, growing itself from within, making up its own rules, evolve within. It repairs itself from within, and the machine has to be repaired from the outside. It has to have an inventor to give it its rules of operation, has to stick the pieces together. And, for example, if you walk away from your computer, you hope it does not change while you're gone, because if it does change, it's not likely to have improved itself in your absence, but rather to have broken down.
Don't we love it when that happens?
Entropic. Machinery is entropic. Humans invented machinery, and they also invented the idea of one-way entropy. It's quite interesting. And they behave entropically on the planet, destroying ecosystems. So now, take not the computer, but your friend. When you walk away from your friend, you hope your friend keeps changing while you're gone, or they'd be dead, right? They have to keep creating themselves. Our molecules are constantly being recycled. You have 30,000 recycling centers in every one of your 50 trillion cells, constantly renewing your proteins. There are some very different fundamental logic matters between mechanism and organism. I found out later that Maturana and Varela had also coined the term allopoiesis, but were using it very differently because they never understood, I don't think, the difference between organism and mechanism. So they say autopoiesis is when something creates itself. Allopoiesis is when something creates something else. So, in other words, they would call a factory producing cars allopoietic. Mm-hmm. So both things are mechanical, the factory and the car, and unless you're counting the workers in the factory. So I think there's a confusion between organism and mechanism in their work. But so I just wanted
to say
that's
an important distinction. I saw that I was, well, when we wrote, we talked about that.
Yeah.
Also, you know, one of the things when we look back at go ahead.
Yeah, before you go on, let me just talk a little bit about what happens when you look at this matter of self-creation in evolution. Basically, I found a maturation cycle in evolution where young species, in creating their place on the planet, in you know, establishing themselves, creating themselves as a species, is about establishing themselves within the ecosystems of the planet. And the youthful species are very competitive and acquisitive. They spread over the land, they reproduce as fast as possible, and they bump other species out of the way as they do so. In ecologists' terms, they are the kind of species you find in type 1 ecosystems, which are called pioneer ecosystems. Very competitive, very creative. They invent technologies and all kinds of things, at least back in the bacterial world they did. And then something happens along the way, and the species that survive essentially discover that you waste less energy feeding your enemy than killing them. In other words, making friends of enemies is more energy efficient, is cheaper than keeping them as enemies. And what you get is you don't have enemies anymore when you feed them and then they feed you, and you develop these highly interactive, interdependent kinds of holarchies in mature ecosystems, which are actually called climax ecosystems. And yet, biologists and ecologists do not see the connection. I see it as juvenile and mature species. That implies that there's a learning of a mature way of being. And I think you can probably already recognize that I'm going back to the butterfly story, back to the old system in the world and the new system. The exploitative, young, youthful, creative, hostile, world that globalized us, and now the need for us to move into the cooperative phase where we don't fight each other any longer, don't exploit each other any longer, and become sustainable. This is the big choice time for humanity. Either we go into this cooperative mode or we fail as a species.
Now, you have a very unique and positive perspective on globalization, and I would love if you would share that. And I want to tell our listeners that if you just tuned in, I'm talking to Dr. Elizabeth Satoris, and she's an evolutionary biologist. And go ahead, Elizabeth.
Okay, so we have these two concepts of holarchy, things embedded within each other, and think globalizing world or think your body, and then the other concept being this concept of a maturation cycle where you learn. And by the way, different species are at different points in the cycle, and that's why you can point to cooperation in nature and you can point to competition in nature, because not every species is at the same stage. And so when you put these two concepts together, think in your body. You know the holarchy. You've got molecules, cells, organs, organ systems, and the whole body. And all of them in a conscious universe where consciousness pervades your body, where your cells are conscious, where they know their place in the body. They know on some level, it may not feel like a human mind, but they know the whole system that they're in, and they negotiate their self-interest at every level. A cell cannot function if it can't meet its self-interest. Neither can an organ. So a heart cell has to meet its cellular self-interest, and the heart has to meet its organ self-interest, and the whole circulatory system has to meet its interest, meaning it needs certain resources to live. It needs certain hormones and certain foods, glucose and whatever, all of those things are constantly, it's as if your body holarchy is in a dialogue where everything is negotiated so that the self-interest of every level is met. Now, jump to world economy. It is not possible to have a healthy world economy if the holarchic level of local economies is unhealthy. So you can't have some nations or corporations exploiting other parts of the world, taking their resources and not giving back, because it's not possible to do a healthy living system unless every level of its holarchy has been meeting its needs. If you think politically, economically about our recent human history, the Soviet Union failed because under its communist system, it failed to let people meet their self-interest. On the other hand, in the capitalist West, self-interest was promoted over community interest. So one side wanted people to sacrifice their self-interest to the community. The other side was sacrificing community to self-interest. If you put those together, you might have something like a living economy. And by the way, while the West was teaching Darwinian evolution about hostile competition, what I call the youthful mode, the communists were teaching Kropotkin, whose book was called Mutual Aid, and that was about nature. So he saw the cooperative aspects of nature. Darwin saw the competitive aspects. Together, you have that maturation cycle. So if you think holistically, you can not only see how the details work in individual species, but you start relating the bacterial world to the human world, to what's going on in the economy of your cells, to what's going on in the economics of the whole world. And everything starts to fit together into a holistic picture of a conscious, intelligent, learning universe in which we are made of spirit, matter, energy. You know, it all fits together. And then you start seeing a human drama in which you're playing. And it gets to be much more interesting, even when you have to deal with the bad parts.
It's more exciting, too.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
So many people today, and so many particularly young people today, just feel that there's no hope for the future. And you know, I see this in a lot of places. I see the opposite, too, when I go to some of these environmental conferences, mm-hmm. of the kids really standing forward. But there's so many that I know that just feel... there's no, the promise has always been, in current history anyway, that our children would do better than their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And this is probably the first time in current history that isn't so. That's not,
right.
that's not the view. So,
yeah.
You know, you talk about, spirit, and I want to bring that whole issue of spirit, because the first in, when you look at, Descartes or Darwin, you know, in the beginning, the mechanic, the big mechanic was God.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point in history, God got pulled out of the equation,
mm-hmm.
and tied into government and business and kept separate. Kind of how I see it. I don't know if
yes.
that's, but now we're coming back to this place where science and spirituality are coming together. How do you see that coming together, and what are the aspects that are important in it?
Yeah, well, what you just said about God being taken out of the scientific equation is very important, because, and this is something Rupert Sheldrake and I came to independently, that in the Cartesian universe, where God was the grand engineer building the machinery of nature, it was kind of logically complete, because God also put a piece of God mind into man, his favorite robot, and so that man too could invent machinery. So you had sort of all the components of consciousness and intelligence and machine building at both levels, right? When you took God out of the equation, they should have taken the mechanical metaphor, the idea of nature as machinery, out as well, because there are no machines without inventors. They are allopoietic, right? And so by taking God out and keeping machinery in, as though machinery just grew on trees, it became kind of an illogical story. Do you follow me?
Yeah. Yep.
What I'm saying yep. here, yeah, that you, if you want to keep the machinery, you have to have some intelligence to design it.
Exactly.
So this became a problem, and so you got the intelligent designers movement, you know, trying to counter the Darwinian story. And in a way, what happens in that little debate is that you have fundamentalism from two sides, or
exactly.
as I say, two obsolete stories trying to duke it out with no intention of reaching resolution, right?
Yep.
So we're trying to figure out how we can find resolution, how we can find a mature way of being. So the juvenile mode, the youthful mode of a species, is necessary. We don't step on caterpillars if we want butterflies. We don't kill off our adolescents if we want mature adults. So there's no point in bashing the old system. It was a necessary stage. It's what globalized us as a species. So now we look at this process of globalization a little differently. We've got the caterpillar and the new world both coexisting, so we have increasingly rapacious big corporations. Now we've got BP, you know, that cut all the safety regulation corners and went deeper than anyone had gone before and, you know, didn't think about that Mother Nature may have a lot of pressure down there when you're going miles below a seafloor that's already a mile below the surface. It's almost unfathomable how deep they go now. And by the way, it does show you that oil is getting scarce, that they have to try to dig that deep.
Yes.
But anyway, you've got corporations who are only looking out for profits, very youthful mode. And you've got the banks that are, you know, have made a commodity out of money. And by the way, in your body, there is a currency, but it's given away freely. There's no money shortage in your cells. The money is just there to make the economy run, not to, get some people fat and rich and other people poor. So we've designed a money system that was appropriate only for the youthful mode. It's a money system very much like a monopoly game, where eventually one kid holds all the money or a couple of banks have it all, and they can trade around debts and all that, complex monopoly game. And what do you do when you've finished playing Monopoly? You either redistribute the wealth and start over, or you play something else. And I suggest that we play a more mature game now, because the expanding economy of capitalism is a youthful mode economy. Once you're globalized and have used up vast resources and are polluting your planet, then you have to shift into the cooperative mode and look at how nature does things and recycle everything. I always say, you know, not all young people are going to want to grow organic food. Some of them will want to be technologists and engineers. And I say, fine, just follow two rules, the rules of nature. No toxins in what you build and 100% recyclable. Go for it. You're a creative species. Solve problems with nice, clean, green machines, right? So there's so much for young people to do, and the good news is that nature is on our side here. Nature wants us to grow up the way other species that live in highly interwoven cooperative ecosystems, how they all, you know, work to feed each other. And it's possible for us as humans, and it's like the old Chinese thing about crisis is opportunity. In fact, nature doesn't do a whole lot of evolution except in crisis, because nature doesn't make the choice between being conservative and radical. Again, it's like, you know, the capitalism versus communism, each having half the system. Nature is profoundly conservative with things that work. It doesn't fix what isn't broken. And when things don't work, it gets radically creative. By the way, I love what happened in England in this new coalition government, where you have a conservative and a liberal, two young men getting together and saying, we can cooperate. We can work together across party lines. This is historic.
That's a good sign. Quite a contrast to our system.
Historic, yes.
Quite a contrast.
And I wish them very, very well. And if they'll really get it, that they should use the strength of the liberal to change things when they aren't working and the strength of the conservatives to hold on to the things that do work so that things don't fly apart or get rigid, then you have a working kind of government. Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be fun.
I think it's a very mature mode they're demonstrating.
I do too, and we need a lot more of those. And it kind of brings me back, Elizabeth, to the individual. I always like to, as we're getting towards the end of the show here, look and see, you know, this is very great to have as a concept and think about and conversations about, and that, of course, feeds it. But it brings us back to how I live my life, my own ethics, my own way of consuming, my own relationships. Can you share a little bit about in the shift from the win-lose corporate structures that we have now to a global win-win kind of relationship with all humanity, that it's all alive, that we're all a part of it, that, you know, how does the individual, besides being informed, how do we grow that and nourish what wants to happen?
Yes. Well, one thing you can think about is think holarchy when you're making decisions and ask yourself, if I make this decision, will it be good for me, for my family, for my community, for my ecosystem, for my nation, for my world, for my spirit? And if it's harmless at those levels that it isn't good on, you could go for it. You're a creative human being. Try it out. But when you think of yourself as not just an individual, but as a member of community, having responsibility to community, recognizing that it makes you feel wonderful when you can help someone else. And you know, we say human nature is greedy and competitive and stuff, and that's baloney. It's just as much our nature to cooperate. Every disaster shows it. 9 out of 10 people at least immediately jump into cooperative, helpful mode and have sometimes a wonderful time cleaning up together and strategizing on how to make things work again, patching things up until you can get them really working again. So there's going to be more and more and more opportunity where we're pushed into this cooperative mode. And that's what nature did. You know, every time there was a great extinction, suddenly there were piles of new species all over, as if nature said holistically, wow, that wasn't working, now we've got to, you know, and reinvent things and get that genome working and build a whole new set of kind of creatures all at once. And we're doing that as imaginal cells. We're getting very inventive, and we think about much more consciously about everything we do. Can I recycle this? Do I need to buy that new pair of shoes? Can I trade with my neighbors so that I can wear shoes that I wasn't wearing last week, you know, because it's fun, but that I don't have to acquire another pair within my community. And I see a lot of community spirit growing in so many places, like with the Transition Town Initiative and things that's just spreading like wildfire around the globe. Where people are getting together and saying, let's count up what resources we have. How much food can we produce locally? How can we use the school buses in the hours at night when they're not being used? How can we share, you know, do more carpooling? All kinds of creative ideas are coming out of this. If you just get people together and say, let's see what it means to reweave community. We've been so focused on, you know, me and climbing the ladder of the corporate world or whatever. And now we have to think, what if the electricity goes out? Do we know how to build light bulbs? You know, if we have to start over, it's a time of great creativity and inventiveness for people now I'm sure that we can power the world, you know, with clean, green energy. And that we can build architecture that's friendly and keeps us closer to nature. And just, we have so much creativity. We're graduating so many engineers. We're finding so many ways to make organic agriculture more interesting, more fun, and easier than the old kind of farm labor was. So I could just go on and on talking.
I love that you go.
Great opportunities.
I'm excited, and it's wonderful. We have a couple persistent callers have been calling. Would you like to take a call from someone?
Of course.
Hold on a second. Hello, caller. You're live on Conversations. Hello, caller. Huh. Just as I said that, we lost our callers. Call back, caller. We'll take you if we have time.
Oh.
So, you mentioned some of the things that people can do, and that not everyone, you know, Lester Brown said we need 8 million new farmers in our country alone, but not everybody wants to be a farmer.
Right.
What do you see as a futurist, some of the emerging, very necessary jobs that are out there in the world? Actually, hold that question. I think that person's calling back. Nope. Oh, well. Oh, hold on here. Hello, caller. You're live on the air. For some reason, our board isn't working, so I'm sorry, caller. We'll have to try again.
Somebody needs to undo a mute button or something.
Something. It's all on, but at any rate. So your thoughts about that?
About all the new jobs?
Yeah, the new jobs, the new, you know, I have a daughter who's just finishing up her master's degree, and there's a lot of kids coming out of school, and some of them, you know, have business degrees and things that might not be that useful. What are some of the things that you see?
I think one thing that's important is that all young people should start thinking of themselves as global citizens, thinking locally and globally. To use the internet to talk to people in communities that have some resemblance to your community but are in a very different part of the world. You know, now you've got all these Facebooks and blogs and things like that you can do that and share ideas, trade around inventive ideas, use the internet. It's the biggest self-organizing living system on the planet because it's made of people. The machines are just the ways that you connect with the other people. And you know, China's graduating, I think, 9 times as many engineers as the U.S. and India about 6 times as many. And they're all going to be thinking, how can we make homes and transportation and everything, you know, cleaner and greener, lighter on the earth, all fully recyclable, things of that kind. And here on my island of Mallorca, for example, we're throwing away tons of orange peels, which could be boiled down into cleaning, you know, organic cleaning stuff made of citrus peels is very effective and smells wonderful, and that could be a whole industry here. We have huge numbers of wine bottles that get shipped back to the mainland of Spain in all colors, and yet we have 2 art glass factories on the island. We could use that glass as a resource and make new things out of it. You know, there's umpteen things you can think of to make out of waste. One woman in Merida, Mexico, started putting all the organic waste, which is I think about 70% of trash because of all the cardboard and paper and things like that that count, through rock crushers and turned it right into compost that could be taken out to farmers' fields using machines that were idle all night. And so, you know, you just think in your community, what resources do we have? What do we need? How can we get more creative? What can go further, have multiple uses, like school buses? Can we set up organic restaurants where we use the school buses to either bring people to it so they don't have to use their cars, or make the bus itself a portable restaurant where you take the meals to people wherever they are. Just get creative. Get kids to start thinking in school, what if my town were sustainable by 2050? What would it look like? Create the visions and then say, and what did I do to make it that way? Project yourself into the future. Think of what you want and then, what do you want to do? Because there are as many ways to build a wonderful new world as there are creative individuals to do it. And I always advise people of any age, do something that makes your heart sing, because otherwise no one will want to do it with you. You have to become an attractor by getting excited about something. Maybe you're a musician. Maybe you're a farmer. Maybe you're an electrical engineer. It doesn't matter what you are. Maybe you're good at languages. Conflict resolution is a huge, wonderful new field. We need to resolve so many conflicts around the world. We need to speak each other's languages. We need to do art. We need to do literature, plays, television, movies. You know, it's a time of creativity, and there's something for everybody. So don't do anything you have to make yourself do. Figure out what you most enjoy doing and figure out some creative way to weave that into making a better world.
That's what I always tell my daughter. Find out what you love and turn it into what, you know, your livelihood. That's
exactly.
Exactly. Go ahead.
Just, you know, the world doesn't owe you a living. The advantage of those of us who came through the 60s were that we realized the butterfly was not going to be funded by the caterpillar. And don't think in terms of I need a grant to do this. Just start to do it. You know, I was so inspired by young Chinese people with no money, no resources, no tools. They would smelt the iron out of their dry earth and make the tools and build the irrigation systems or whatever. And, you know, it didn't take money. It took huge amounts of motivation.
Well, we finally got a caller, but it's actually too late now. I'm sorry, caller. But what a joy to have you on, Elizabeth. And I just want to thank you for your decades of work, for your clarity. I want to tell people that they can go to your website, which is, would you say it for us?
Yes, it's 3 W's, Sahturis, my last name, S as in Sam, A-H-T-O-U-R-I-S, Sahturis.com.
And I should also tell people that there are all kinds of wonderful, the butterfly video is in there. There are other videos and many articles that you've put up there. So anyone who's interested can can go to your site.
There's a whole copy of Earth Dance, lots of articles, some even a funny YouTube video called Body Economics.
Right. I love that. We're just going to have another show sometime. It's been such a joy having you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. I enjoyed it.
Take care.
Good.
Bye, Elizabeth.
I'll say goodnight. You say goodnight.
Oh, that's right. It's 11 o'clock there.
Right. Okay.
Night now.
Take care. Lots of love to everyone.
Thank you. Bye. Well, we are blessed. I am so sorry, caller, that we couldn't get you on the air. Just a lot to talk about, and I didn't want to stop her since we had her all the way from Mallorca on the air. Well, thank you all for listening. I just appreciate so much the support that you gave us in the pledge drive, and also for their support. Thank you to Sacramento Natural Food Co-op presenting the class Father's Day Feast, wherein participants learn to prepare spinach and artichoke dip, roast beef tenderloin with mushroom stuffing. I'm drooling on the microphone. And more. Tuesday, June 15th at 6:30 p.m. Complete class schedule at Sac Food Co-op.